My name's Damon. I am an alcoholic.
Damon.
Good morning, Cartersville.
Yeah.
Everybody awake? All right. My sobriety date is August the 10th of 2004. A couple of people saw me when I was just coming in here. And so grateful to see you, man. And a lot of times, I've just really told my story, but I think you're asking me to do something a little bit different here. And so I thought, well, I've done my story before where I've woven it together with traditions. I've done it where I've woven it together with the St. Francis Prayer, which I think is the quintessential spiritual tool in this program. But I'm gonna weave it together in a way I've never done before, or at least attempt to, which is through the steps. And just go into each one of the steps. And hopefully out of this you'll get enough history about how I got here and whatever. If not, my story's on the WeJoy many different times out there. In fact, I'll go ahead and record this one. I tend to put a lot of information out there. I tend to put a lot of data. So if you want a copy of it, I'll put it up on the WeJoy afterwards. Because what I'm really going to go through in a lot of ways is how I walk guys through the steps and weave my story into that. And see how that goes. So are you guys up for that?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. I was born in 1955. I'm 67 years old. I was born in Atlanta. I used to say I was one of the rare Atlanta natives, but a guy I sponsored actually lived in Atlanta, and we lived in East Point, three doors down from the boundary. And so I'm not, okay, fine. But anyway, anybody else get pleasure by sneaking around? I think my old definition of success was I got away with it again. I remember I had a pull your pants down club with a girl at 6 years old, and we were the only two members, I sniffed glue when I was 8. When I was 10, my sister turned me on to marijuana. Now we're into the 60s, And then there was, of course, the LSD and all of that other stuff. But, I drank first to get drunk when I was 12. We put the clear stuff in the Sprite bottle and the colored stuff in the Coke bottle, from the parents. And then we drank it all to make sure we wouldn't get caught, got sick. My sister found me. My mom was away for that one day, a rare thing. Most of the time she was at home. And my sister came home, and she cleaned it all up and told her I had the flu, and so the next day I didn't have to go to school. So it was one of those things where somebody once said, in the beginning it was just great and no consequences. And then later on it became all right, but on occasion there were consequences. And then towards the end it was nothing but consequences, right? So when I look at, for me, I was one of those who had a lot of potential if I only applied myself. Anybody else identify with that? Told that? So it was when we moved up to Marietta in third grade, today they give the kids Ritalin, back then they gave you Paddling. I got several times the Paddling. I thought it was kind of strange the guy had decorated the paddle. I don't know if anybody remembers any of that in the days gone by. But anyway, my parents took me to a child psychologist, and he just said he's bored. So my parents, who didn't have a lot of money, my dad had worked his way up, but they sent me to a private school. And again, I didn't really appreciate the sacrifice that they made in order for me to do that, And maybe my sisters made sacrifices too, because they didn't necessarily get to have the kind of clothes they would want or jewelry or whatever it might be because of that. So there's a lot of times when I just didn't appreciate what I had. We were talking about gratitude, earlier as a way of life. And just not being grateful for where I was born. My mom said my life landed jelly side up, And it just in so many different ways. But I went to that school, and I was kind of the bullied at that school. I was kind of the guy from the country, But in my neighborhood, I was one of the ringleaders. We had a three-story tree hut with, in three sections wide. And they actually had a thing for spin the bottle in the top story, We never used it. It was just hopeful. it was designed in just in case, But anyway, I'm one who I got expelled from. In 11th grade, I had smoking privileges at this private school, and then they got a new headmaster, and I didn't have them. Smoked anyway, got expelled in my senior year. And my parents said they could probably get me back in, and I just wound up graduating from Wheeler High School down there. But I could just at that point put my head down just about and take the test because I've been at this college preparatory school. Mm-hmm. And my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. And they had a room for me there, but it was a town of 2,000. I'm a guy who used to hitchhike and go down to Atlanta. And, you know, I remember hearing the Allman Brothers play in the park for free. And I was selling joints out of my guitar case. And the hippies were there. And there was one of the hippies there, though, kind of a key part for me was he asked me, I've been doing these things with the Lutheran Church, and he said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? And I was thinking, well, you know, if I was born in Saudi Arabia, I would be Muslim. If I was born in India, I might be Sikh or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist. Or why does it matter where I'm born? You know, and I remember sitting on top of Kennesaw Mountain and looking out and trying to imagine the curve of the earth and thinking, you know, this is a pretty big place. I wonder what's on the other side, you know. So anyway, I worked I got a job through my sister who was a Kelly girl, so I was a Kelly girl, but I was shredding insurance documents for a big insurance company. And I always had a pretty good work ethic though. I think it's because I needed to earn all my weed, you know, money for my weed or something, but I mowed lawns and, you know, I was always doing a little something. So when she got me that job, I was just shredding these and just trying to have a game, you know, let's see how fast I can do them. And they were impressed and they gave me a full-time job. With the best title I've ever had, I was chief inserter in an insurance company, but it was inserting mail into envelopes. It didn't have to do with anything with all the women who worked there. But I still like the title. I worked there and I began to see all these people as I delivered the mail on occasions, and I saw that they had applied themselves and they had gone to college and all this. And also I saw some of Ross Perot's people there in their white shirts and everything working, and I would carry around racks full of computer cards, you know, and stuff. And I got a little bit of exposure to that. And I thought, you know, they're probably not a bad idea to get a college education. So I went back down to where my parents were, just north of Auburn. I couldn't get into Auburn because of my grades. But I applied myself, and I went to a junior college there. I applied myself, even though it's kind of an extension of Alabama High School, you know, at that place. But I still did what I was supposed to do. And graduated and got 4.0 there and all the way through. Actually taught guitar while I was there. And so they kind of considered me part of the staff. And then I decided to get higher education, and I called up Colorado Information. Back then, that's what you had to do. And asked them what colleges do they have there, and they said Colorado or Colorado State. And I flipped a coin, and it was Colorado State. That was my planning for higher education, because I just really wanted to beat the mountains, you know, and go up there. And it turns out I was going to go into Eastern history. In fact, that's what my degree is in. In the history of Asia and a year of Chinese language while I was there. Also met, butted into a conversation with two gals on a couch, and we're going to celebrate 44 years married this next week.
Yeah.
This coming week on the 5th. I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. and I'm very blessed for that. Before we got married, we actually said, you know, divorce is no option. And that's not saying anything about anybody who's been through a divorce. I'm not saying that. It's just that was our mindset going in. And I benefited a lot from that. And I'm really a guy who didn't drink alcoholically through the 80s. I quit smoking weed in sometime in the 76ers the whole circle disappeared except for a few people, you know, and the ones who were really the friends. I worked in a nursing home for a year there. I took a year off while my wife was, or girlfriend at the time, was doing her residency in Texas. And I worked in a nursing home, and I got to see people there who had been married for 75 years, who were 105 years old or 94. And I saw the families who knew how to handle it and the families who didn't handle it too well. And I got to see the principles at work. You know, principles in life. Later on, when I got sober, I went back and started being a caregiver one day a week. And I did that from 2004 up through 2014 or something like that. The guy sold the company off. And I still say that's a really great way to get. There's so much wisdom there. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we moved back to Atlanta. I'm a guy who I wound up taking, I was going to go into international business. I took two computer courses, and it just seemed that my history degree was just perfect for it. And I got a chance to play around with the first, you know, the very early PCs and what they were doing there. Later on, I got a job with HP, and it was in the 90s when the internet was just kicking off. I got involved in that. Hell, I was born before Sputnik, okay? If I look back at what time that I lived through and everything that's happened, this is incredible time, you know? But there were times in my life when it was not enough. It got that way towards the 80s. My son was born in 84. My daughter was born in 1989. And then all of a sudden, I went from being this optimist to start looking at what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my job. Mm. And I'll tell you what, if I'm looking one way or the other, I'll find evidence for both. You know? And what happened was that I had a guy who I worked for me, and he went to a, he was getting married, so it was a bachelor party, and went to a belly dancing thing, and then we went to a strip joint. You know, I said, well, I guess for camaraderie. And here was a pull your pants down club, like, you know, grown up style. And I went, well, I'm not getting this at home. Again, the negative thinking. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of weeks later, I was working hard on a program and just tired and worn out. Maybe I need a massage. So I go to, and the lady offers me the full treatment. And I accept, you know. But I'll tell you what, the guilt started kicking in. Because Mama had raised me better than that. I come from a very... My mom's natural state of being was to be of service. That's just who she was. Good family, my parents, great relationships with my sisters. This is kind of important here, you know. I've got no reason why I'm alcoholic. And I like the guy who said... let's say that I'm alcoholic because my mama had a square nipple and she potty trained me sideways. Let's just say that that's the reason I'm an alcoholic. Now, what am I going to do about that? You know, I think I'm going to practice these principles on my affairs, carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers, try and develop and maintain a conscious contact with a God I cannot possibly understand, and then try and add to the quality of the lives of the people around me. But since I don't know why I'm an alcoholic, what should I do about it? I think I should practice these principles in all my affairs, carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers, try and develop and maintain a conscious contact with a God I cannot possibly understand, and then try and add to the quality of lives of the people around me. So if you're in here looking for why, it don't matter. It doesn't matter where you've been, what you've done. It doesn't change what I should be doing from this point forward. And so I'm a guy who finally I wound up I would do this thing where I would drink for a while and then I'd quit and I'd feel good about myself and I'd brush myself off and I'm working in a data center so I can come and go however I please and I got all kinds of great excuses. Work in a data center 24/7 shop, you got all kinds of excuses for your wife and for everybody else around, you know. Sneaking around, great one for sneaking around, except the guy I was hurting was me. You know, and the guy, my future guy, too. That's another guy to consider, by the way. Who am I going to be tomorrow? Who am I going to be next week? One of the things I've found out is that the guy who drinks gets all the benefit. And the guy who comes to the next morning pays all the price. Isn't that, and that's a bad deal. I would not go into business with that guy. You know, but at that moment, I would get relief, and I would stop drinking, and then I'd start getting a little bit restless, a little bit irritable, a little bit discontent, like a pressure cooker building up, and I would change my mind about quitting. So, I'm going to go into the first step, and what's that all about? You know, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And for me, I'm powerless in this sense. When I drink, I become a different person. Has anybody ever told you that? Mm-hmm. So how can I say what that guy is going to do after he puts drug alcohol into my body? I cannot know. But I'll tell you what I do like to ask the guys that I'm sponsoring is, what are you powerful over? See, I'm powerless over the light coming from the moon and Alpha Centauri, and, you know, I'm powerless over so many different things. Let's get it limited down, okay? What am I powerful over? And because that's really all I've got to work with. And for me, it comes down to just three things, which is my actions within the limits of what my body can do. My attitudes. I can literally decide whether I'm looking for what's good about this world or what's not. And I can change it. Oh, I love this table. Oh, I hate this table. And I have the choice. Anybody familiar with Viktor Frankl? Viktor Frankl was a Freudian-trained psychiatrist before World War II, also Jewish, and he spent his time in Auschwitz. He lost every family member except he and his sister. And he's in the depths of this of despair. They've been, you know, they kept him alive to do medical experiments on him. And, you know, and he was at his lowest point, and he realized there's one freedom they can never take from me. And that's the freedom to choose how I'm going to let the circumstances of my life affect the quality of my life. And he realized he wanted to say, let me see what I can learn from here that I can then take to my students after the war. And he wrote a book called Man's Life, Search for Meaning, and it's still published today. And it's fascinating. And let me tell you, this affects the second part of the first step. And it says my life is unmanageable. Well, my life's unmanageable because I'm trying to manage all my circumstances. Let me get all my circumstances just right, okay? And you stay put, too. And you put the phone down. Put the phone down. Then I'll be happy. You understand what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? So now it's definitely affecting my serenity here. You understand what I'm saying? If I'm trying to manage my circumstances, that's self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is circumstance-centered. Because I don't see that she may have a very good reason for being on that phone. Who am I to see? Get off the phone. You can see how you guys all laughed about it, right? And it's the same way. If I'm sitting there managing my circumstances, I'm ignoring how those changes that I want to have made to my circumstances impact anybody else. So my life, what I ask people in that first step is, what is your life? You say it's unmanageable, but maybe you have it misdefined. And to sit down and say, what is your life? I just look at it sometimes and say, do I have it defined in such a way that it is manageable? When I do define it properly, then it's very manageable. When it's all my circumstances, they just don't stay put. Now, if we left those books and everything like that, just like that, and left here and come back and nobody touches them, they'd still be there. But that doesn't work with the organic world. My wife will not stay put. She will not be the same person from day to day. So I have to have a different set of tools. So the second step is that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, insanity, the three definitions, the lowest, the cheapest one really is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Well, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Or how about doing the same thing over and over again, knowing exactly what the results are going to be, and doing it anyway. Well, if all you've got is a hammer, you're going to take that screw and just try and pound it in with the hammer, because that's all you've got. But the greatest form of insanity, and that's for us who've got a little bit of time in the program, is having the solution and not using it. You know, I've got the tools. I'm about to get angry. I know that forgiveness is the thing I need to use. And I like Sandy Beach. He says, why do we choose forgiveness last? You know? So that's the real insanity. So what I do like to ask guys to look at and define is, what is sanity? We're being asked to be restored to sanity. I think it would be a good idea to have kind of a little bit of an idea about what that is. So I get them to write down, what is sanity? What are we shooting for here? And for me, sanity is practicing these principles in all my affairs. All of a sudden, 2 and 12 are tied. We've just tied them together. All right, now, What do you mean practice these principles? What principles are you talking about? How do I practice them? That's why we go to meetings. I hear different people who don't practice them, and this is what they get, and other people who practice them, and this is what they get, and I learn equally from both. You know? Love to go into a meeting that's broken, you know, because and everybody's messed up, and I go, oh, good, that really reminds me how crazy, because I'll realize I was doing that yesterday. Wait a minute. You know, and I can begin to see myself, and then I can go, oh, wait a minute, you know. I remember I was driving down to IOP, and I realized I was being judgmental about people who were being judgmental about people who were being judgmental. And it was some people were talking about people who were gossiping, you know. And then somebody was talking about the people who were gossiping, and then I'm thinking about the ones who were talking about. And did anybody ever remember the movie? It was Matthew Broderick. It was War Games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it had the Whopper computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trying to play thermonuclear war and realizing it keeps trying to figure out a way to win. And it was also comparing it with tic-tac-toe, and it all of a sudden stops, and it says, what a strange game. The only way to win is not to play.
Mm.
And so today, in terms of, instead of going into the judgment part, I like discernment. You know what the difference is between judgment and discernment? Judgment says, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be playing with your phone. You know, discernment says, I need to be one who... Do I want to adopt that into my design for living, or do I not? And then I can stop right there. I don't have to go further. I can just say, do I want to adopt that into my design for living or not? And it was funny because I had a guy I worked for who was a lawyer, and he was very judgmental, and I said, well, he works around judges all the time, and then judges wear robes. Very interesting symbol. I thought, what's the symbol of the robe? Well, it says the constituents have given them the authority to be judgmental in this particular case.
Mm.
And so it comes into, do I have the authority and do I have the responsibility?
Mm.
If I don't have the authority, I don't have the responsibility. And there are cases, you know, where I can be. You know, if somebody asked me to sponsor them, in some ways it's saying, can you be a little bit judgmental about how I'm practicing my program? And okay, fine. But I do like Father Joseph Martin, who said, the best advice I can give you is don't give any advice.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I give advice, first of all, I have to know enough about you to give advice. And I don't even know enough about my wife to give her advice after 44 years. The other thing is, people do not execute my advice the way I think they should. Okay? And the third thing is, I'm then responsible for your outcome. That's why we have this tradition of non-professionals. Professionals are responsible for your outcome. All I can do is just create the conditions where healing can occur. Whatever happens after that is the magic of this. Doctors do not heal. They create the conditions where healing can occur. Farmers do not grow crops. They create the conditions where it's been known before that that particular seed has been able to grow. Different seeds grow in different soils. There's a wrench for every nut that comes through the door in terms of sponsoring. I love that, you know? So if we go into step three... Really, step three is a decision to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I love that line. When we read the promises, we have the promise of your choice, because we have pages 62 to 63 in there. You know, we have page 164 as one of the promises. We have, there's a whole list. We've got about 15 different ones that are various promises out there. But the one on page 63 is, I have a new employer being all-powerful. He provides what we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. And to me, the thing, Bill Wilson wanted to change part of the wording of the third step prayer. And if you look on, as Bill sees it on page 210, it takes out the word victory. And when I first read the word victory in there, I said, that doesn't make any sense. The actor did not get victory. The actor who wants to run the whole show forever arranging lights, he doesn't get victory. But what Bill says right before that, he says, he is the principal, we are his agents. An agent in a production is the person in the background who's making sure the bathrooms are clean, that the lead actor has the coffee the way they want it. But, you know, they're peeking through the curtains, making sure everybody's having a good time. Their name is not on the marquee, it's not on the program. Can I become an agent rather than have to be on with my mask? What mask am I going to wear? The actor, more than most people, leads a double life. Double life, that's being generous. How about four or five? You know, who do you want me to be? I was this person with this group, that one, and I don't have to wear that mask anymore. I can play the role I've been assigned, which is called me. I like Sandy Beach, who was talking about when I was born, the little baby comes out and goes, I didn't choose this. I like that. It's kind of fun. So the third step really is just a decision to go through and do the others, right? And I've got to get to that point where I'm not carrying around just a little bucket of power. This is my little bucket of power, you know. What I have to realize is I've tapped into an unsuspected inner resource, but also it's an outer resource. When I practice these principles and I start becoming responsible, I start hooking up with responsible people. When I'm acting irresponsibly, who do you wind up hooking up with? A bunch of irresponsible. All of a sudden, I see the world as irresponsible. It was my choice. When I start being responsible, I start tapping into responsible people. When I do that, they show up when I need them, because I show up when they need me. In so many ways, this thing emerges, you know, by me taking the action first. Not waiting for somebody else, but when I start doing these things first, then I start attracting, it's attraction, not promotion, I start attracting the kind of people that think that life is a neat idea. In step four, then we're just going through the inventory, you know. And by the way, in step four, on the resentments, I like the idea that Bill says in the sex inventory that we can treat the sex inventory the way all of our other problems the same way we do sex. And in that inventory, he has a last column, which is what should we have done instead? So when I lay out the resentments, I put the last column is what should you have done instead? Because otherwise, yeah, I can say, yeah, I should. This is my mistakes. But I want to finish up with a positive. I want to say, okay, what should I be doing instead? And so I like that. So Bill gives me justification by saying we can treat all of our other problems the same way we do sex, and he has that in there. So we go through these different things, and all of these things are the barriers that have been blocking us. My son came into the program a year and a half after I did. I talked with him maybe 15 minutes and realized I was part of the problem, not part of the solution in that sense. And it wound up, you know, I used to hand out the CDs and all of that, and it turns out that Red, he was working with Red, who a lot of some of you know, and Red was sticking these CDs in and playing them as they went from job to job, and my son was getting immersed in the AA program, and he's now got 17 years sober. He just had a baby girl born in September, and grandson just turned 2. So they're the older one. That's my older. My daughter's our grandson is 12 now, and I get to be there for him. I want to tell you one of the things about step one also that I realized. Remember I told you how I quit and everything? I like to tell newcomers, whatever you do, for God's sake, do not quit drinking. Do not quit drinking. How many times have you quit drinking?
284.
You counted, right? Did it work? And I got this because I told my story at the jail, and this guy came up afterward and said, boy, you convinced me. When I get out of here, I'm going to quit drinking and using. And I said, for God's sake, don't. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? I said, well, hold on. I'm still formulating this. I don't know if anybody else has seen that happen, you know, and all of a sudden something will just come, these moments of clarity. See, this is a program for starters. It's not a program for quitters. This is what third step, fourth step, fifth step, this is about starting to be a good father, starting to be a good husband, starting to be a good citizen of the world. My daughter, who's very interesting in terms of alcohol, when she drinks, she gets the phenomenon of craving, the way the doctor presents it, which is, I can't predict how much I'm going to drink. Anybody here ever drink against your will? I got a question for you. How can you use your willpower not to drink against your will? If you drink against your will, how can you use your willpower to not drink against your will? On page 85, Bill says, every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. It is the proper use of the will. So the idea is that I need to be the good father. Spend my time doing that. Okay, I can't quit drinking. I can start being a good father. And when I look at the things a good father does, drinking's not on the list. There's a very big difference between quitting drinking and starting to be the kind of person I've always known I could be. And 6 and 7, I think, are the pinnacle of the program. Especially as you get older and get more time in the program, I see a lot of people talking about this. It's like this. A lot of work coming up, you know. But in 6 and 7, it's basically giving myself permission to never work on my character defects ever again. You see, it doesn't say in the 7th step, and this is why I want to make sure I get the wording just right, because it says right in here, humbly ask him to help me remove my shortcomings. Now, wait a minute. Does it say? No, it says humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I don't have a part in the removal. What I do is I have to acknowledge what is a character defect and what's a shortcoming versus what is a principle and a character asset. I need to acknowledge that. But this is like, don't think about the pink elephant. You know, don't think about the 57 Chevy with the nick in the steering wheel. That's from Jimmy Egan saying that. I can't not do something. What I do is, if I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs, how much time do I have left for character defects? So there's a concept that the Catholics had called contra virtue, and for each of the 7 deadly sins, there was a virtue that was the opposite. And the one that I remember is the opposite of envy is gratitude. So instead of trying to get rid of my envy, I am to practice gratitude. So I find out what the opposite of that is. By the way, character defects are sins of commission. Shortcomings are sins of omission, is the way I like to look at it. Things I should have been doing that I wasn't. Things I did which I shouldn't have done. And if I'm practicing these principles on my fears, I don't work on my character defects. When I really get that, then what happens is, after a while, the thoughts pop into my head still, but after a while, not so often. Not so often. You know, and that's the miracle of it. The idea about the thought of the drink goes away. We've seen it happen. If you're sober at any length of time, I look back a week and I go, I haven't thought about drinking in about a week. I didn't do that. What I did, I was going to meetings, they would have me work on the steps, all this stuff, I got to write this stuff down, all this stuff. What good is this doing? How does this keep me from drinking? And then I go, wait a minute, I haven't thought about drinking in a week. Not entertaining it. Let's not talk about thinking, let's talk about entertaining drinking. Entertaining drinking is where I get the rag out and I'm dusting off the dining room table and I'm dusting off the coffee table and putting the doilies out. I'm about to invite that beast back into my house. I'm entertaining the thought of inviting alcohol back into my life. And yet, the first time he came in, he was fun. He danced around. We had all that fun. Yeah, I threw up. Yeah, I got to next day. I did, you know. But we had a good time. And then later on, well, he stole something, you know, from my mom. But my parents had to lock the liquor cabinet. I found out how to unscrew the screws off the hinges so I could get it. When they built the house in Alabama, they made it locked so you couldn't do the hinges. And that shows what kind of, you know, honesty, you know, sneaking around that I did. So now, 6 and 7, when I really get those, then it's very easy on 8 and 9 to just write down, because now I want to get rid of these things, because these are the things that are blocking me from doing my principles. You know, this is part of the principles, is becoming a responsible person. And not for what it does for me, but to try and do what I can to create the conditions so that person can find healing. It all becomes so easy once I take that 6 and 7. And the 10th step is interesting in what it does not say. I love, in a lot of ways, to look at what the book does not say. Just like with 7. The 10th step does not say, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were more wrong than the other guys, promptly admitted it. Are you with me? Anybody ever use that out? You know? The idea is, Sandy Beach talked about it, and this was a case where, and it's in 2009, I was at the Woodstock of the South. Sandy Beach was talking, my mom's cancer had just come back, And he talked about in step 10 and the 12 and 12, it is a spiritual axiom that whenever we are disturbed, there is something wrong with us. And he said, what's wrong with me? It's this other guy. He says, you're disturbed. Oh, yeah, okay, I'm disturbed. He says, well, there's two things you can do. All right? If the other guy is wrong, you forgive. Got it? Okay, good. Okay. And if you're wrong, you make amends. That's it? That's all I have to do for disturb? Yeah. If the other guy is wrong, you forgive them. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Somebody cut me off in traffic, I've learned now to say, that must be a hard way to live. In fact, I saw that happen just the other day, yesterday. Day before yesterday. Motorcycle, doing all this stuff, and then all of a sudden, a tow truck in front of me kind of puts his lights on and gets off the side of the road, and I pull around, and there's the guy on the motorcycle laying on the sidewalk. Yeah. You know, it didn't look like he was conscious and everything. It wouldn't help for me to stay there, but it was one of those things where I would just, and I had not been cussing him out either. I just realized, you know, that's a hard way. You know, I'm messing around. I'm playing around with principles there, you know, that I don't need to. So this idea is about forgiving. I want to talk about it real quick because it's so powerful. I was involved in these big contracts with these outsourcing in HP. And let's imagine that I loan you $30,000 and you're to pay me back $200 a month. Okay? And 2 years later, you haven't paid me a dime. And I got $40,000 in credit card debt. I'm coming after you. But if I've got $4 billion in the bank, and I value our friendship, I can tear the contract up. Look in your lives, look in your relationships. What secret contracts do you have with the most important people in your life? Hmm. What little contracts have you? Have they read the contract? Did you write it down? I have all these little clauses out there. Well, they should know that. They should know that. But the idea is I can tear up the contract. I like the version in the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Because I get that image of I can tie power. I have the, today, if I've got this little bucket of power, then I have to come after you. If I've tapped an unsuspected inner resource, if we've, and on 63, we felt new power flow in. If I've got like a pipe connecting me to the Pacific Ocean, which is when I tap into the principles, I tap into the power. We have a priest in our group. When he practices the principles, he taps into the power. When he doesn't practice the principles, he doesn't tap into the power. And if you want to know what I believe, look at what I do. Hmm. Not what I tell you, but look at what I do. And I have to say that to myself. It's a great way of looking at what do I really believe. So I tap into this power. And if I practice the principles, I tap into the power. And all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by these other people who think that's a neat idea. And all of a sudden, I have more power in my life. It's a very real thing. And so 11, it's very interesting. Bill has one prayer, and he repeats it throughout the book in different wording. Instead of praying, say, okay, God, remove this, you know, you say, remove this particular defect of character. I'm going to take out the other one, but, and the prayer, though, says, praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. My way of asking God to remove my character defects is to practice the principles in all my affairs. Chuck Chamberlain, when somebody asked him once, what is prayer? He said, you're not going to like it. Tony, anyway, he says, every serious thought is a prayer.
If you want to.
Every serious thought is a prayer. I kind of like that. You know, can I, this thinking that I have right now, could I stand up in front of the First Baptist Church on a Sunday and be able to tell people what I'm thinking? You know? And the other thing is, the most important person I talk to during the day is me. And I've decided not to use loaded words when I talk to me. Would you like to get rid of all your problems just like that? I'm serious. Would you like to get rid of all your problems just like that? I renamed them situations. Have you ever had a problem that wasn't a situation? And just what happened already when you thought of your problem as all of a sudden being a situation? They took some of the air out of the balloon, that emotional air out of it. I've replaced all my cuss words with one word. Interesting. I was changing a mower blade on a riding lawnmower, had the deck off, and I went like this, and it slipped and cut my knuckle, and it was, oh shit, no, no, interesting. And it was over the next, I can't even tell you where it is. My body healed it all up. All I had to do was create the conditions, and it, I had to clean it and put the bandage on it and watch it, and now it's all healed up. It was interesting. Also, I don't use miracle. I'm sorry. I think that's a loaded word. It says everything else is not. What in your life isn't a miracle? You know, miracle also defies the laws of nature. Don't we? No, they follow along with it. And just them in themselves are astonishing. I like the concept of wonder and awe. I'm not much on acceptance. I think acceptance is good. If you're just coming in, acceptance is a step, great step up above pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I think it's a great step up. But to me, I think I need to climb back up into wonder and awe. Look at my hands. Go. You know, I like evolution. I think it's a neat idea. I'm a chemical reaction, been going on for 3.8 billion years. That's a neat idea. Maybe 6,000. Who cares? It's still a long time. And I didn't pick my parents. See, this is the essence of humility. I didn't create me. What? Did I pick my parents? Did I pick this time that I lived in? This last 50, 60 years have been the most amazing time on this planet. We can now call somebody in Africa on a cell phone and they'll answer right then. What's happened here is astonishing. And you know what, for the alcoholic who's still out there? It's not enough. To be, each one of us is so successful when you think about it. We're all success stories. And when I can just get into wonder and awe, even a fly. Fascinating thing. I change the alternator in my car. All it does is change circular motion into, you know, alternating current and then back to direct current. And this fly is this little thing like that. It can fly around. My car can't fly. Can I get wonder and awe? Can I get marvel in the ordinary, as Earl Hightower says? Can I marvel in the ordinary? And so 12 is this thing, is like Sandy, he says, once somebody's gone through these, try and keep them from carrying this message. Try and stop them. Cat Stevens has got that song, I can't keep it in, I can't keep it in, I gotta let it out. I gotta show the world, the world's gotta see. See all the love, love that's in me, said, why walk alone? Why worry when it's warm over here? You got so much to say. Say what you mean. Mean what you think, and think anything. Yeah. This isn't about quitting. This is about starting. And I'm in a constant state of arrival. I'll finish up with this. I have a little card that I have that I hand out sometimes. It's kind of a mantra. I don't have one here with me. I got it in the car. But the idea is this. Explore and tend with kindness and integrity. I need to stop being a seeker. If I'm seeking, then I've got this imaginary thing. I don't know what it is. I'm seeking it. Oh, no, you're not it. No, this isn't it. No, you're not it. No, that's not it. And I'm never finding. When I'm seeking, I'm never finding. But if I'm exploring, everything, every being has value and a role to play. Everything, the fly has something. Everything I pick up has something. God could and would if he were explored. I see people get in trouble with the seeking. No, explore. There's, God is everything or he's nothing. What is there that's not out there that's just amazing today? And I do it with kindness, which is from the root kin, which is family. We are all deeply interrelated and interconnected. It is language which connects us. No other being, no other species on the planet has language. They communicate, but they can't talk about what we're talking about here. They don't have this. We are deeply united with what Bill called the language of the heart. If you get, they have a language in the gangs in prison. You have a language in the crack houses downstairs. Okay, but I can move in this. I can move towards this language group that thinks this is a neat idea, and now we share this. And the final thing is integrity, which is the awareness of the alignment of my actions with universal principles. So I can, the awareness is the thing I'm most powerful over. When we talk about what am I powerful over, when I can just step back and pause and just be aware without naming things or anything, I suddenly get the right thought or action comes. If I can just pause through the day and just stop and acknowledge I'm at my destination. I'm at the only destination there's ever been, which is right here, right now. And there's a significant difference between right here, right now, and 5 seconds ago. 5 seconds ago was a memory I have. Right here, right now, this is the really big show. And I wanted to escape from it from drinking. But I'll tell you in another way, drinking actually brought me into that moment where I didn't want thinking about the past or the future and all the things I had to do. I could come into here. It simulated a spiritual experience. But it's not the real thing.
Amen.
I think that's enough. Thanks. Mm-hmm.